Well, good evening. It is May 18th, and you're inside the Opium Den. We'll be calling Jack Cole this evening, and Jack is the Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, more commonly known as LEAP. And we're going to have a conversation with Jack and have him tell us what's going on with LEAP and other things in the news. So let's give this phone a call, and we'll get Jack here. One ringy dingy.
Hello, it's Jack Cole. Can I help you?
Hello, Jack. Daniel Williams. How are you?
I'm fine.
Welcome to the Opium Den.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with me tonight. I think it'll be very informative for our listeners. We're getting some pretty good action here at the Opium Den, so that's a good thing. So I kind of set you up at the top of the show for all of the listeners. So, but I would like you to give us start out, if you wouldn't mind, give us a little history of LEAP and how you came to be involved.
Okay, well, let me introduce myself for your listeners first. I'm Jack Cole, and I'm a retired detective lieutenant with the New Jersey State Police. I retired after a 26-year career, and 14 of those years I worked as an undercover narcotics officer, so I was certainly there long enough to learn the horrors we have created in this war on drugs. And when I retired, I sat down with four other police officers, and we decided, we were trying to decide what should law enforcement really be interested in doing. And when we boiled it down to what we thought was the essence, we decided that should be that we would be interested in reducing the incidence of death, disease, crime, and addiction. And sadly, Daniel, as you well know, all four of those categories are just made infinitely worse by the war on drugs. So that wasn't what we wanted at all. After much study, we decided what we do want is, as our name implies, law enforcement against prohibition. We want to end drug prohibition, just like we ended alcohol prohibition in this country in 1933, because we view this from a law enforcement viewpoint, and we understand that the day after we ended that nasty law, Al Capone and all his smuggling buddies were out of business. They were off our streets. They were no longer out there killing each other to control that very lucrative market. They were no longer killing us cops charged with fighting that useless war. And they were no longer killing our children caught in crossfire and drive-by shootings, all the things we experience today. So we know that if we legalize these drugs, we can take the violence out of the equation entirely. But then if we regulate the drugs, we can actually end overdose deaths because people know what they're taking, and they don't have to die when they know what they're taking.
And that was the case back in the days prior to the Harrison Narcotics Act. People that consumed these narcotics knew exactly what they were consuming, and there was a very low incidence of accidental overdose. Is that what you think?
That's absolutely what I think. I couldn't agree with you more. And it wasn't just there that we saw this difference. We saw this difference when we made the mistake of making alcohol a prohibited item. Under alcohol prohibition, alcohol poisonings reported to hospitals increased by more than 600%, and it was for exactly the same reason. There was no longer any control or regulation over how those things were produced. That's why, you know, we hear the stories of bathtub gin. People drink it and go blind, drink it and die. It had nothing to do with alcohol. It had everything to do with the fact that nobody knew what they were putting in that concoction.
So obviously you and these three other fellows saw the parallels to alcohol prohibition, in the drug prohibition aspect. But when you guys sat down to talk about this, I mean, even today it's a fairly radical idea for former law enforcement individuals to come out in favor of repealing drug prohibition, but what type of resistance and the like did you find when you first sat down and put this idea together? Did people look at you like you were crazy, or how was your acceptance level among your peers and among others?
Well, it in our mind, it was what you just described, but in truth, it wasn't that at all. We thought it would be much, much harder than it is, and we thought we would have a far harder time convincing people than we do. We were hoping we might convince maybe 10 or 15% of our audience that our goals are correct. And it turned out that after just 10 or 20 talks, we were convincing 80% of our audience. And that was quite interesting to us. It's certainly something we didn't think would happen. It was exciting, really.
I'm sure it was very exciting. How much of that audience was former or current law enforcement personnel? How were you accepted inside the Fraternal Order of Police, as it were?
Well, to give you an idea, we started with those five founding members, and today it's 7 years later, and we're not just cops. We're cops, judges, prosecutors, prison wardens, DEA, FBI agents, and others. We got 13,000 members in 90 countries, and we started going to law enforcement conferences, conventions, national and international, 6 years ago. Excuse me, 5 years ago we started that. And we've been to over 35 of them now. We try to get a speaking gig at each one, but that's not always possible. Sometimes we get a workshop or manage to get on a panel. But at every one of the conferences, we put up a educational booth there that's staffed by LEAP speakers. And we're very aggressive. I tell the speakers, you don't sit behind that desk or that table. You don't stand there, because the only people you will talk to, if you do that, are the people that are on your side, and we want to talk to the people that disagree with us.
Well, that's a very...
We are very aggressive. We stand out in the aisle, and anybody that comes down that aisle and so much as looks at us, we got them by the elbow saying, hey, have you heard about law enforcement against prohibition? We're cops, too. Let us tell you about the war, talk with you about the war on drugs.
Well, you know, you mentioned your exposure over in Europe and all these different countries. I had an interview with Danny Kushluk from Transform the other day, and he spoke very, very, very bright fellow. He spoke, spoke very well of LEAP, because in his mind, he's aware of all of the drug policy reform groups over here. But as you know, Transform, they have the same opinion or the same advocacy as LEAP and me and several others out there, that repealing drug prohibition is the only way to go, not the incremental methods. And Danny felt that LEAP was probably the strongest advocacy of all the groups here in the States. So, and I know you know Danny well, and he said to say hello, but I find that very interesting. That's why, as far as LEAP is concerned, once I got past the surreal aspect of former police officers and then judges and the like on my side of the table, once I got past that, I got very comfortable with LEAP, and I got to tell you, I think you guys have it right on going for the full repeal and bypassing the incremental steps.
Well, so, thank you. Let me mention, too, that it's not because we're saying things that are necessarily different. I mean, you just said that you agree, you say the same kind of things. The difference is we have a credibility that other people saying this just don't carry with them. Because other people can say they spent their entire careers, most of their adult life, trying to reduce drug abuse. And we haven't changed our mind about that at all. We still want to reduce drug abuse. We don't condone drug use just unless it's being used for a medical purpose. unless it's not being abused, let's put it that way. Of course, the drug warriors, if you use it, you're abusing it. It's automatic. But we know that that these illicit drugs are similar to alcohol and tobacco, and we know that people can use those without abusing them. When somebody does abuse them, then that means that they themselves feel that they need help with this stuff. And at that point, we should create some sort of helping agency that can give them a hand with whatever they need to get over this abuse. But just the idea of prohibition to us is the thing that is the wrong thing in this situation. You know, prohibition itself has created so many of these harms that the drug lawyers would tell you are drug-related, like they talk about drug-related crime. Well, in truth, drug-related crime, meaning somebody takes a drug and as a result of the drug commits a crime, is almost non-existent.
That's right, it is.
Sure. The crimes come because of prohibition. The crimes, especially the crimes of violence, that is almost totally driven by prohibition. You know, Al Capone wasn't drunk on alcohol when he ordered the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And these drug cartel folks down in Mexico weren't high on heroin, cocaine, or methamphetamine when they ordered the murder of 7,500 people just since the first of last year. That is just the way you do business in an illegal market. So if we legalize these things and set these markets up the same as all other legal markets, they wouldn't need the violence. They could, you know, when was the last time you heard about two Budweiser distributors shooting it out of the supply of your local town?
Exactly. And your point about drug violence and drug crime, when I was researching my book, I went back and read some of the police blotter and newspaper articles prior to 1914, you know, when all the drugs were legal and readily available without that much regulation, but they were legal and readily available. But I didn't find I found hardly any stories where the words drug crime or drug violence were used in the police reports.
Yeah. It's true. It is absolutely true. And of course, the other violence, the violence that is a result of prohibition, is just so horrible and so blatant. For instance, what's going on in Mexico right now is just unbelievable. And the reason for it is the drug cartels are bringing in about $25 billion dollars a year from the drugs they're selling in the U.S. And with that money, they can buy guns that can outgun the Mexican army down there. Plus, over the last 10 years, the Mexicans say that about 100,000 soldiers have deserted. And they're going directly over to the drug cartels and working for them for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times.
Yeah, the money's a lot better.
It sure is.
Back when Vicente Fox was president of Mexico, he had a legalization bill that he was about ready to sign, and then pressure from the Bush administration made that go away. And now we have Felipe Calderon, who is going to decriminalize the possession of personal use drugs in Mexico. And I'm wondering, one, if you think that the Obama administration will come down on him like Bush did on Vicente Fox, or do you think this will actually become law? And if it does, what do you think the impact will be, both on both sides of the border?
I'm not sure if Obama will come down on him. There's been some things that happened. Are you aware of the drug decriminalization in Portugal and the report that was just done by Glenn?
Yes, I am aware of Portugal's successful experiment. Yes.
Yes, absolutely successful. And that was from, in 2001, they decriminalized all drugs. And as a result of doing that, things that have happened there that I didn't even think would happen. For instance, it never occurred to me that just by decriminalizing drugs, you'd get a reduction in overdose deaths, but that's what happened. And there was a reduction in all drug use. No matter which drug it was, the rate of use went down since 2001.
And
everything has gotten better than it was before they decriminalized. That's a pretty amazing thing.
Well, it is amazing. And a similar situation is going on in Amsterdam, although not as broadly, because they still have laws against the narcotic drugs. But in Amsterdam, the statistics show that because of their tolerant attitudes towards cannabis, they have a lower per capita rate of use than we do. And then the people who do use begin at an older age. So it kind of dovetails exactly with the Portugal experiment, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. As a matter of fact, the Netherlands' per capita use of soft drugs like marijuana and hashish is one half of what it is in the United States.
I know. You can't go any place over in Amsterdam without bumping into a cannabis cafe. So I think that's, I mean, so we both know these things, and obviously our government knows these things. So let's move into the drug policy arena here with President Obama, and I'd like to like your insights on what you think about President Obama's drug policy and Gil Kerlikowske being our new drug czar. So just give us your thoughts on that, if you would, please.
My first thought is that I have some hope for a new drug czar that comes from a city like Seattle, where they have marijuana is the lowest priority for police action, lower yet than jaywalking. And from a state, Washington State, that has medical marijuana, and where they have the Hemp Fest in Seattle every year, which is staffed for security by Seattle police officers, and they never make an arrest over there for any kind of marijuana violations. So that gives me a little hope. However, and it also gives me a little hope that he's saying now that he wants to do away with the idea, the term, war on drugs. But the fact of the matter is, you know, a rose by any other name still stinks the same if it's the war on drugs. It's just, this is a terrible, terrible situation, and calling it something else isn't going to make it better.
Yeah, it's very, very similar to Obama's decision not to use the war on terror anymore, but some type of, I think it's a politically correct term, like man-caused casualties or something like that, but still we're bombing everything that moves along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border.
And so that's what you got to change. You got to change the action, not the term.
Right.
And you have to change the policy, and the policy we should change is we should legalize and regulate all drugs. Then we'll have a better situation. But you can call this anything you want. It's still going to amount to a heck of a lot of people being arrested.
Yeah, I mean, they're still going to chase down every pot smoker and pill popper and everybody else that's in the illegal drug market, regardless of what they call the effort. They're still going to continue the same tactics, it appears, in a very broad sense. I know that President Obama has ordered the DEA to stand down in states where, you know, medical marijuana laws are on the books. But
and that really gives me hope. I thought that was terrific, that because that's going to save a lot of people from being arrested. And, of course, you know, we've got now 21 states, 21 out of 50, that either have medical marijuana or have decriminalized some portion of marijuana. So that will make a big difference that the feds aren't going in there.
Well, I agree, but I also have to look at it from the actual reality on the ground. the medical marijuana patients represent a small sliver of the overall population that consumes cannabis. And I don't want to minimize the importance of marijuana as the efficacy of marijuana as a medicine, but it's always kind of set, you know, funny in my craw that medical marijuana is such a huge rallying cry. And I want to ask you I've asked Ethan and everybody else this question. Do you think medical marijuana is the proper strategy to move the drug debate forward?
Not at all.
I love you, Jack.
Huh?
I love you, man.
Thank you. No, not at all. I think this whole policy is not something that's going to be nibbled away like ducks, you know, in these little incremental nips of medical marijuana, decriminalize an ounce of marijuana, give somebody the right to hand out free needles, lower the mandatory minimum sentence in one state and then another state. You know, it would take us 1,000 years to change all the laws that way. But I think this is going to work on a tipping situation that it's, instead of being the incremental thing, as one of our speakers, Jim Brush, so well puts it, he says, he thinks that drug policy is something, this current drug policy is something that is just like a car driving over the edge of a cliff, and in one day it's there, and the next day it's going to be gone because of this tipping situation. Everybody's going to say, oh, you're right, and run to the other side, and suddenly we're going to have legalized regulation of drugs. There are so many reasons for this that we should do this, and just the fact that we just discussed that 80% of our audience agrees with this. If we could speak to everyone in the world, we'd have 80% of the world agreeing with this, and it would force the politicians, the policymakers, to change this policy.
Well, then why do you
have to do? We're going to have to force them to do it.
Right, but then why? I mean, I agree with you completely, but then why do you think that there is such an emphasis on medical marijuana? Like, you know, the Marijuana Policy Project is primarily medical marijuana. Medical marijuana, Americans for Safe Access, primarily medical marijuana. The Drug Policy Alliance, although they're a little broader in scope, but most of their focus is on medical marijuana. So why do you think that they're taking that strategy?
I think they think it's an easier place to get a win. You know, those folks are good folks. I don't
absolutely
want to knock any of them, and these are good ideas, and we support them all, and we go out and we speak for them whenever we're called to speak for them. The only difference between us and them, two differences, one thing is when we speak for it, it's cops, judges, and prosecutors saying, hey, give these people this thing. But this thing that they're asking for, it's like drug policy 101. It's the simplest part of this. But if you really want to reduce death, disease, crime, and addiction, you have to talk about legalizing all drugs.
Oh, that's right.
And we always back up the incremental stuff, but we always add, you have to legalize all drugs.
Yeah, I understand that. But I was reading in the Wall Street Journal today about how the conservatives, how the Republican Party have put together dossiers on all potential Supreme Court nominees that Barack Obama may make. And it struck me as it was interesting because they had all coalesced behind a single idea and a single tactic. And it made me think, like, I mean, again, I support all of the drug policy reform groups out there, but we seem to be fragmented. And if we were to unite in a unified position going for the brass ring of repeal, it would seem to me that we would get there much quicker from a unified standpoint, as opposed to you guys do this and you guys do that. And it just struck me reading that today, where how the Republicans are coalescing behind a single issue.
Yeah, I hear you. But on the other hand of this, Daniel, these other groups are backing us. some of them backing us with money. I mean, we get our funding from many of these organizations you just mentioned. Some of it, a great portion of our funding comes from the organizations you just mentioned. And what that means to me is they also understand that we're going after the correct thing here, but they're still after the thing that they can make some headway with a little faster. And I can understand that. And I can understand, for instance, to me, if the government was smart enough to just give all these folks marijuana, just legalize marijuana across the board, say, well, here's a drug there hasn't been an overdose death on in all of recorded history, we'll just give you this. If they did do that, about two-thirds of all drug policy reformers would just disappear. And the other drugs and the other problems, which are tremendous problems, would never be addressed at all, because I think all the money would go out of the funding and most of the reformers would be gone. But if, on the other hand, if they did do that, if they legalized marijuana across the board, it wouldn't reduce overdose deaths by one person.
No, and actually, it would not. And one of my theories is that if let's say that marijuana, recreational and medicinal use, becomes the law of the land, and we don't do anything about the other drugs, and some of the money, you know, that we're funding these organizations that were mostly marijuana based dries up. One of my fears is that you're absolutely right when you say that the violence really isn't going to change, the overdose,
right,
the disease, the crime, and that could possibly create a backlash against the legalization of marijuana, because they would say, look, you told us a lot of crime was going to go away, you told us these things would stabilize, and that they could possibly go back and revisit the legalization and regulation of marijuana, and it could be a negative, especially if the violence across the border didn't change, if the Mexican cartels really do derive as much revenue as our reports say from the marijuana trade. If we take that revenue stream away from them, it would make sense that they're going to need to replace that, and they may step up their operations with narcotics, and the violence could escalate if we legalized and controlled marijuana. So I'm a little concerned about that. Do you think that's a good concern, or I'm just too paranoid?
Well, I think it's a reasonable concern. I'm not so worried about escalation as I just am about if it just stayed the way it is. That's bad enough.
You're right.
And as I say, it wouldn't reduce overdose deaths by one. It wouldn't reduce these deadly diseases of AIDS and hepatitis by one. And yet we know the Center for Disease Control in this country says that half of all new cases of AIDS and hepatitis can be traced directly back to intravenous drug users sharing needles. Well, you don't use a needle for marijuana, so it wouldn't reduce any of that.
Right, and candidate Obama was on record as saying that he believed needle exchange, for those very reasons you just mentioned, makes a lot of sense, and that's what he would implement as president. But now we have President Obama, when his budget guy Orszag went through the budget ostensibly line by line, there when he was finished up, there is actually particular language that says not one federal dollar will be spent on needle exchange. So, candidate Obama, President Obama, where do you see the problems there, and what do you think is going to be? What's he going
They're
to do?
They're having quite a debate, aren't they?
Yes,
President Obama and candidate Obama.
Yes, they are.
I don't know which side's going to win here.
Well, yeah, on the issues that make most are most important to me, I hope candidate Obama beats out President Obama. But let's go on to another subject that's going on right now. Tell me what you think about Senator Jim Webb's bill, SB 714, which is to create the National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009. Give me your take on that.
I think it's a terrific bill, and we've got it a video of him presenting that front and center on our website. If anyone wants to go to leap.cc, or if you can't remember that, copsaylegalizeddrugs.org or .com, You'll see it right there, and we have a petition going. We brought up that old Hoover petition for the Hoover Institute petition was signed on by a lot of very important people some years ago, and it was the point of it was that it was to try to get people to create a blue ribbon commission to study drug policy. Well, I think this particular thing is going to give us that. And right now, Senator Webb is talking about it as a commission that will investigate all of criminal justice from top to bottom, but with the view to why are we arresting and imprisoning so many more people in this country than any other country in the world.
Do you think it's
and
a Trojan
the
horse?
To that is drug policy. So it has to be drug policy that they end up talking about.
Right. Do you think it's a Trojan horse for President Obama on his drug policy? Do you think he's got Webb putting this together to give him some political cover plus some information and use this when he makes change to drug policy? Do you think that there's some kind of conspiracy or collusion going on between the two?
Well, I'd love to think that was the case. I don't have any reason to. But whether it's the case or not, I think it's going to work out very well. And right now, we're trying to somehow get on that commission. I think it would be wonderful if we were represented at the table.
Well, that was a question I asked Ethan. It seems that the commission is going to have five Democrats, five Republicans, and one chair. And maybe you can clear this up for me, Jack. The five Dems and the five Republicans, are they going to be taken from the political class, I mean the congressmen, or are they going to be outside people? Because I also noticed in the bill they talk about using NGOs and outside experts. So are these 10 members... Five Democrats, five Republicans. Are they going to be members of Congress, or do you know?
I really don't recall. There's two bills out there right now. There's one in the Senate and there's one in the House. And the one in the House is directed strictly at drug policy, a commission to investigate drug policy. And I can't remember which one, but one of those, it specifically says that the people serving on the commission can't be members of the Congress and can't be members of the government that are going to do the investigation itself and report back.
Now
they've got to be people in the private sector or former members of government or something. They can't be people that have an obvious bias because this is the way they make their living.
Yeah, I mean, if Webb's commission comes out of Congress, I'll have even less enthusiasm for it. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm not enthusiastic at all. Again, any time that we can move the debate or at least alter the dialogue, I'm all for that. And some people I talk to believe that it's a Trojan horse, and some people believe it's not. But I would like to hope that it is. And one sign, I think, would be... That President Obama could give without costing much political capital and more than likely increasing his stature is that during this commission period, which is probably going to end up being close to 2 years, it's an 18-month commission and they haven't got it resolved yet, so it's probably going to take a two-year time frame to get this thing wrestled to the ground. But the objection and the outrage that I have is that during that time frame, About 1.5 million Americans, mostly younger ones, will be arrested for the simple possession of marijuana and thrown into the criminal justice system that Webb's bill is meant to overhaul. So I'm thinking if it is a Trojan horse scenario, President Obama could come out and say, during this commission time, we'll take marijuana at least out of Schedule 1, or do something to lessen the damage and the hurt that will happen during that commission to 1.5 million, mostly younger people. And when I put that question to a couple of guys, I was shocked. They said, well, you know, we really think this web thing is right, and these 1.5 million individuals are basically collateral damage. And I about lost it when they thought of it in that, and you know, were able to think of it in that way. Don't you think Obama should say something?
Collateral damage is a very poor term, and collateral damage means that they, at least in war situations, it means that you're giving up people's lives in order to get what you want. I wouldn't look at it as collateral damage at all. I would just look at it as this is the business that's going on, and if you can't stop it, it's going to continue. And I don't think it's going to stop during the time that they're discussing this.
Well, don't you think President Obama, I mean, he's a great orator, and he's got a lot of things rolling. I mean, do you think it would cost him too much political capital to do something like that? I mean, there's
absolutely.
So many. Absolutely. Really? Why? I mean, why?
Well, whether it would or wouldn't, he thinks it would. Look at the way he dealt with that question. The main question in his internet town hall, right?
Right.
The question about marijuana. What was it, 3.5 million people weighed in on those questions? And
exactly.
This question rose to the very top.
Right.
And then he makes a joke of it?
Yeah, and then he joked it off. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, so he thinks, and this is the important part, he thinks that this is a non-starter for him, so he's not going to do it. Doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It's just it's not going to happen.
Well, I disagree in the context that I don't believe it would cost him too much. It would cost him any political capital at all. I mean, who's going to rail against him for making a humane decision like that? Just all the John P. Walters and members of that little fraternity. I just don't see where it would cost him. I mean, he doesn't have to talk about.
I think it'd be a lot more than John P. Walters.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
the Republican Party would be up in arms. Whether they agreed with this or not, this is a good. This would be a perfect way to get at a Democratic president.
But don't you think the American public would overwhelmingly support a compassionate midway decision like that, and Republicans be damned?
Yeah, I think they would. Actually, I really think they would. If you look at the surveys, it's obvious that they would support it, right?
And that's
why the surveys are all on our side.
Exactly, and that's why I don't believe it would. If President Obama really believed in his heart that drug policy needs to change, he's on record in film saying the drug war is an utter failure. Why don't his political antennae understand that it would be an overwhelmingly positive step to take for the country, and it wouldn't be a problem at all? That's the only thing that bothers me about that. He can't make even a small statement now that he's president versus, you know, the candidate Obama. If, you know, you agree, I agree that it would be he would be overwhelmingly supported by the electorate, and who cares what the Republicans? It would just serve to make the Republicans look even more out of touch. So, why he doesn't do that, I think, is more to the fact that he doesn't want to, as opposed to he thinks that it would cost him too much political capital, because that just doesn't make sense that it would.
Well, okay.
Okay. Well, that's just what I think about that. But so, what would you like Webb's commission to come out with, his recommendations? What do you think will happen, and what would you like to happen?
To come out with a recommendation that we stop the war on drugs, that we treat drug abuse as a health problem, that we end drug prohibition for all drugs.
Well, that's what you and I want. What do you actually think will happen?
I think if we can get a real commission hearing, it'll turn out just like the Schaefer Commission did for Nixon, and it'll be something that suddenly some politicians are going to have to deal with, because it's not exactly what they thought would come out of it. If we get an honest rendering of the facts in a real good study of cost and benefit of the war on drugs compared to cost and benefit of legalized regulation of drugs, it has to come down on our side, because it's so factual. There's the other side doesn't have a leg to stand on at all.
Well, they haven't had a leg to stand on. They haven't had a leg to stand on for 40 years. I mean, when you look at it.
But we've never been able to get a commission to really do a real cost-benefit analysis. So they could always say, well, I think that if this happened, things would get worse. But if you look at it as scientifically, base it on strictly science and on factual analysis, we've got to win. So things have to get better.
So this interim period of 18 to 24 months,
it's going to be 24 months. It's going to be after the election. You know that. There's no way that they would come out with the finding on such a thing like this before the 2010 election.
Oh, yeah, it won't come out before the midterms. There's no question. Okay. So, I guess it remains to be seen. I'm not all that optimistic. I mean, I like the idea that it's on the table, but I've been, you and I are both were a couple old dudes. We've seen blue ribbon commissions come and go for 40 years, and mostly their stalling tactics, and the good and the bad ones are routinely ignored. So I want to.
Maybe the reason I'm more positive about some of these things than you is because not only has my organization given 4,500 plus presentations to people around not just in this country, but maybe about 500 others in other countries around the world. I have personally given about 880 of those presentations. So I've personally seen that many times how I walk into a room where there might be 5 or 6% of the people in the room that agree with me, and 30 minutes later there's 80% of the people in the room that agree with me. And it's not because I'm such a good speaker. It's just because I tell the truth. And I have the credibility behind me of being law enforcement. So people say, I'm going to listen to this person. And if you can get them to listen, we're all saying the same thing. The whole thing that makes LEAP so dynamic is people will listen to us. See? And when you see that over and over again, like I have for 6 years, you start getting a little bit optimistic about what's going to happen here.
Well, what about of all of the speaking engagement that you and other speakers of LEAP get? What percentage of those of your audience is current law enforcement personnel? Do you do much within the police organization, or are you mostly out?
No, just in going to those conferences that we attend.
What do you think about being able to talk to active police organizations? Do they not want to be in the same room with you, or do they agree with you privately but can't support it publicly?
I just did an hour presentation right before you came up, and when I do my presentations, I'm usually using a PowerPoint presentation, so
right.
I never get lost on anything. But did we discuss LEAPs going to these law enforcement presentations or law enforcement conferences?
No, we've not discussed that. That's what I want to
do. Okay, let me explain this.
Yeah, please do.
This is important.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is how we make our contacts with law enforcement. We go to their conferences, to their national and international conferences. We've been to 35 plus in the last 5 years. And when you go to them, we set up a display booth there that's an educational booth, and we bring in anywhere from two to three, four speakers, depending on the size of the conference. And I always tell all our speakers, you don't sit or stand behind that table, because if you do, the only people that are going to talk to you are the people that are on our side, and we want to reach the people that disagree with us, because we can change minds. We do it all the time.
Yes, and how does that work when you're speaking with, when you go to these law enforcement conferences and you speak to a lot of the law enforcement personnel? What's your take on how the active police force views your mission?
Well, let me explain this in two different points.
Okay, good.
First point is let's stick with the booth for a second, and then I'll go to a workshop situation, and that was amazing. This is what we do in workshops. Anyway, when we're at the education booth, we stand in the aisle, and anybody that comes down that aisle so much as looks at us, we got them by the elbow saying, hey, have you heard about law enforcement against prohibition? We're cops, too. Let us talk to you about the war on drugs. And then we keep very careful track of what happens. Less than 1% refuse to talk to us at all. And of all the other people that do talk to us, the last thing we say to them, and this is after just having a 3 to 5 minute tops conversation with them, the last thing we say is, so what do you think? Does this argument have any merit? Do you agree with us? We need to end drug prohibition, or do you want to continue this war on drugs? Or have we at least made it so that, you know, there's some doubt in your mind and you're undecided? Whichever one of those three things they say, we put that down on a little scratch sheet in the column, and at the end of the day, we tally them up, and we've been doing that through 35 conferences, you know, week-long conferences. And we were amazed at the first few conferences at the stats we got, but they have held true through all 35 conferences, and that is, after we talk to law enforcers, 80% of them agree with us. Only 6%, after we talk to them, want to continue the war on drugs, and 14% are undecided. Now, that is an amazing thing. And, you know, we found something else out by doing this. And I guess I always knew it, but it hadn't really occurred to me as strong as it is. If I go up and speak to one, say, police officer at a conference, I'm almost guaranteed that he will agree with me. But if I go up and I speak to a group of three, not one of them will agree with me. Because law enforcers are so concerned about being labeled soft on drugs, soft on crime by their peers, they won't say, you know, in their presence, what they really believe about the war on drugs. But you get them alone and they will. So one of the most important things that LEAPS has done is it's allowed police officers to really say what they believe. And they're in the majority, the people that say, this is useless. Why are we doing this?
Well, how do we translate that acceptance and agreement with you guys, you know, one-on-one? How do we get that out into the public arena? How do we give these police officers the cover to stand up for their beliefs? I mean, I understand the fact that it's the law.
We do it by doing exactly what we're doing, creating this organization. LEAP is modeled on Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and it's not my idea. It was Peter Chris, another founding member's idea. It was a phenomenal idea. And it really works. You know, remember during the Vietnam War when the Vietnam Veterans Against the War came out against that terrible thing, what would you say to them? You might not agree with them, but you couldn't argue with them. What are you going to say? You're not patriotic? Well, they were there. You don't know what's going on? They were there.
I understand that, but I guess I didn't. Let me rephrase it. If you have this high level of agreement inside the police forces, when you're at these conferences and the like, how do we get those same police officers when they go back to their precincts and go back to their cities to work off of that idea as opposed to just going back and enforcing the law?
Well, one of the ways is, as I just said, we make it legitimate for this discussion to occur among police officers. When they go back, they don't have to say, you know, I think we should end this stupid war on drugs. It's terrible. All they got to do is say, did you see those cops that were at that last conference down at the display booth? They had that educational display booth down there. They're talking about ending the war on drugs. They're talking about legalizing all drugs. What do you think about that? Did you hear what they had to say? That some of that stuff made sense, you know? So they're not saying that they believe it, that they should do it. They're putting the onus on us, and that's what we want. Fine. Point us out. But every person that they talk to is now thinking, gee, there are cops out there that think this. You know, maybe this isn't such a such a taboo subject. Maybe I can talk about it.
And do you have anecdotal evidence that that is actually, making a difference, at least in the minds of the police?
Anecdotal evidence on that, because we have people who have then joined us and said that they heard about it from somebody else that was at a conference and was saying that we existed. And so they went to our website and said, gee, this is okay. I want to join this.
So how many existing members of your 13,000 do you believe are active duty police?
Not very many. There's only about 10% of our law enforcers in this organization are active duty. And we have 70 speakers. I think only about, it's about 10% of the speakers, too, are active duty law enforcers.
Oh, really? I didn't know. That's very good. I didn't know that.
Yeah. But it's fairly low. I mean, that's 10%, that's only of our speakers. That's 7 speakers. And we've got a couple active cops that are speakers. We've got two working prison wardens. Actually, we had 3, but the one retired. He's still with us, but he's no longer acting. We got 3 working cops. You know, one of them is Neil Franklin. He retired a major from Maryland State Police, and then he got a job with Baltimore Police Department, where he was a lieutenant colonel. And then he quit there, and now he works for the Maryland State Transit Police as a major. So he's got some phenomenal background, but he's a working cop, and he's a speaker for us.
Well, the attention that drugs have gotten recently, I mean, not only has it been a lot more attention than normal, but the tone is different. We're not just talking about interdicting 50 tons of cocaine in Miami. We're talking about real substantive issues on how to move forward with drug policy. And I'm not so sure if it's going to be an Obama top-down deal, or more than likely it'll be a bottom-up through the grassroots. But I'm very encouraged, and everyone that I speak to is encouraged. So how do you think the conversation is going to develop, and how far away do you think we are from actually reaching the tipping point and repealing drug prohibition?
Just a second. Let me get my crystal ball out. I don't know. And when reporters ask me that question, what I always say to them rather flippantly is, I don't know when it'll happen, but if it happened next week, that's a week too late, because in this coming 7 days, we're going to destroy a lot of lives of people by arresting them and imprisoning them that don't have to be destroyed. So if it happens tomorrow, it's too late. You know, we want it to happen at the very earliest point. I told you, I'm very optimistic. When in 2002, when we put this thing together, I and everybody that was putting it together thought that we were creating something that would go for generations. We thought it was that much in place. But today, almost all of us think it'll be over within 10 years.
That's my thinking too. I'm glad that we're on the same page as well on that. So I got one more question here, and then I'm gonna let you finish out, and we're getting close to the hour time. But and take as long as you want on this question. If you could design the regulated market for drugs, how do you envision that infrastructure, and how do you think it'll look?
Well, I can tell you what I would think. I can't tell you what LEAP would think, because this is the one place that we try not to set any kind of policy.
Oh, I understand that, but I'm asking you personally. Yeah, that was what
okay. I just want, but I want your audience to understand that it's me talking, it's not LEAP talking. And the reason we do that is because our speakers and our members span the entire spectrum of politics. And depending on your politics, some people have different ideas of how this should work. Everything from the very laissez-faire people saying, leave it up to the open market to do it, all the way over to the other point where people are saying the government should control everything, and I happen to come down on the government should control everything side. Here's what I would say. For most of these drugs, I would set up a situation sort of like what they have had in Switzerland for the last 15 years now. The short way to say this is I would give free maintenance doses of drugs to any adult who requested them. And the key word here is free. And my reason for saying that is I believe that the surest way to reduce death, disease, crime, and addiction is to take the profit motive completely out of drug policy. And to do that, you not only have to take the profit motive away from the potential drug dealers illegal, but you have to take it away from the potential legal dealers of the drugs, and you've got to take it away from the potential dealers in the government to make money from it, from taxing and everything.
When you say give away maintenance doses, you're speaking primarily to addicts, not the recreational cocaine user or things that you're speaking of.
No, I'm talking about to abusers.
Okay, just clarifying. That's what I thought about.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for doing that, Daniel. When you're not in an abusive situation, it would be a different situation.
Right.
A lot of our people think that almost all these drugs should be treated similar to alcohol, where in some of our states they have state stores. In this case, there would be no advertising whatsoever of the drug, including no branding on the packaging. So you could say one package is better than another package. And it would only be sold to adults, and it would be quality control, standardized measurement, and for potency and consistency, and that would be a government job to do. So that we could end the overdose deaths, because people would know what they were taking.
Where would they buy it? In your scheme of things, where would they buy it?
In my scheme of things, I'd probably have several different manners for it. I'm not sure what you'd have for marijuana, because after all, marijuana is something that anybody that's got a flower pot can have in their own house. So.
Right, but the issue would be the narcotics. I think that would be
the hard narcotics. So, for instance, heroin. Heroin for 15 years. Let me explain what happened in Switzerland. 1994, the Swiss people said, we're tired of arresting our children for making the mistake of using heroin. We're going to treat this as a health problem. So they set up 23 clinics for a pilot program around the country. And if you were a heroin user, you were allowed to come into those clinics and inject that drug up to three times a day using medical supervision, clean needles, medical supervision. There were also job specialists, educators, social workers there to wean them off the drugs, and it really worked. Something in the 20 percentile of those folks quit using any drug at all. And, of course, the reason they say they had such a tremendous high number of people quitting using any drug was because they were no longer treated as criminals. They were treated as a health problem. When you got a health problem, you go to some place and you fix your health problem, and there's no stigma attached. You can go out and get a job after that. It's not like being a criminal,
Right.
So they had that. The second thing they had is not one overdose death there in 15 years. That's amazing. Think of all the lives that were saved. Because they're no longer sharing needles, AIDS and hepatitis, which was tremendously high in Switzerland because of the policy they had before this was the failed needle park policy.
Right, so you would have a maintenance.
What?
I'm sorry. You'd have a a free maintenance program for our addicts, and I think that's exactly right. And you said, you know, marijuana is a plant. You really can't do much about that, although there would be some type of regulated, some type of market like there is in Amsterdam, not the exact model, but
yeah,
there would be.
Yeah, I agree, Dan, but let me just make these points about this thing in Switzerland.
Sure.
AIDS and hepatitis dropped the lowest per capita rate of any country in Europe because of this project. Crime was cut by 60%. Now, if you're a heroin user, you no longer had to prostitute yourself, women or men, either one. You no longer had to break into someone's house at night and steal a television set, and if you get caught, it might become a violent crime. You didn't have to do any of that because the drugs were distributed on a sliding scale, but if you didn't have any money, they were free. And because the drugs were free, there was no dopers on the streets selling heroin where these projects are, because you can't beat free what fool would buy from you, right?
Exactly.
So if the dopers aren't out there, they're not killing each other, cops or kids. And more important yet, and this was just shown to be true by a 10-year study done by the very prestigious medical journal, The Lancet, British medical journal, that showed in Zurich, as a result of this 10-year study, it shows an 82% decline in new heroin users. 82% less. Imagine that.
Yes, because the maintenance.
And what they attribute that to is the dope dealer is no longer in the community,
right,
rubbing shoulders with these young people to entice them into becoming that next heroin addict.
Exactly. I mean, that's ABC logic. Obviously,
that's right.
These maintenance clinics aren't going to be out recruiting people to start taking heroin like
exactly.
The dealers do. They're going to maintain the existing population.
And, so that's something that's really happened, though. Really happened. An 82% decline. And it worked so well that last December they had a nationwide referendum, and the vote went very strongly to make this a nationwide policy, which it is now.
And also the marijuana or the cannabis initiative failed primarily because they didn't want to be another cannabis magnet like the Netherlands. Is that correct?
By the way, that's another thing that comes out of this Portugal decriminalization.
Mm-hmm.
The study, they discovered that there is no magnet effect in Portugal, where they decriminalized all drugs, and because they decriminalized all those drugs, there's been a drop in drug use. Every kind of drug, there is less use now than there was before they decriminalized in 2001, and they have experienced no magnet effect whatsoever in that country.
Would you think possibly?
So it's busted all these myths wide open.
Do you think possibly? You know, now that in Portugal, you say there's lower use and the like, but and I agree. But could it possibly be because the estimates were high when you don't really have any type of per capita data and you got a crystal ball, like you said earlier? Do you think that once they finally did decriminalize and have a better handle of on how these drugs are bought and sold, that the utilization prior to the decriminalization wasn't as high as they thought it was?
I think this is a very well done study. I got a copy of it in my hand right now. It's by Glenn Greenwald, Cato Institute, and it's so well done. I would think that he covered that sort of thing.
Covered it pretty well.
From my reading, I don't think I have that kind of problem with it.
So we have a
get a copy of it. It's amazing.
Yeah, we have this excellent system in Switzerland. We've got decriminalization in Portugal. We have the Netherlands experiment. What more do you think we need in our country to get to reach the tipping point? I mean, I understand what we're doing and moving forward, but I mean, is there something that can just crack this code, or is it a matter of more people knowing about Portugal and Switzerland and the Netherlands? I mean, what kind of picture do we need to paint to the American people to further their understanding and force our politicians to move off the dime?
Well, we need to get the information out that we already have, which you just said. there's so many places around the world that's made very clear the fact that as soon as you loosen up some of these laws, as soon as you start thinking in terms of compassion, and as soon as you start trying to treat this in any way like a medical condition instead of a crime condition, everything gets better. So all we've got to do is get the power to make that public. We've got to be out speaking every day. We've got to be, and we're doing really well, at least since the first of the year, because of this terrible downturn in the economy, which is horrible for all of us in one way, but it's
the silver lining.
Very good for this situation, because it's ending alcohol prohibition happened at the height of the Great Depression.
Yeah, we were broke.
Not a coincidence at all.
No, we were broke.
You can't afford prohibition when your economy is tanking.
Well, that is the silver lining, I think, of our economic problems that we're having, is that, as you mentioned, alcohol prohibition ended because we were broke, and I think we're pretty broke right now. So I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful that that's going to be the issue that pushes it past the turning point in the electorate.
We just commissioned a study with Harvard University professor Jeffrey Myron that was published in December. That the study was what would be the outcomes monetarily for the U.S. Treasury if we legalized all drugs in this country and taxed them just at the rate of alcohol and tobacco. And his very conservative study found that that would mean a minimum of $76.8 billion extra in the Treasury every year.
Not to mention the couple hundred billion that we spend directly and indirectly fighting prohibition. That's where the real money is, I think, the money we won't be spending anymore. What do you think about that?
Well, he worked that out. $40 billion of that would be saved.
$33 billion
would be revenue coming in.
I look at some of these studies, and some of them, when you look at the federal direct expenditures and state and local direct expenditures, that's, roughly anywhere from, 95 to $120 billion a year, and then you have all the indirect costs that are related to the incarceration and the like, and I've read a couple of estimates where it's about $200 billion a year that we expense on the drug war. Do you think that number's high?
Well, LEAP from our studies puts it at $70 billion, right around there, and it's got to be loose. You just make it the best you can, but we figure just the money spent on prosecuting the war on drugs, that would be interdicting drugs at our borders and beyond, spraying the crops in developing countries, chasing around the people that receive the 90% of these drugs that come right through that sieve of our border, and then prosecuting them, bringing them into court, prosecuting them, and then housing those that are found guilty and sentenced to prison, some for the rest of their life. That expense we put at $70 billion a year.
Mm-hmm. Well, any way you look at it, it's an awful lot of money, and the money itself is not the greatest benefit. It would be the social benefits of reducing our crime by at least 50%. That's the real benefit, I think.
Sure, and can you imagine, what we always say is, our whole idea is to offer people hope for the future instead of removing all that hope by arresting people and imprisoning them and taking away their chance for their livelihood, for a job, for apartments, for education. And we say, can you imagine a world where instead of spending $70 billion next year to create harsher mandatory minimum sentences, imagine a world where today we legalize drugs, and next year we spend that $70 billion to create programs that give people hope for the future. Instead of mandatory minimum sentences, how about mandatory minimum education for everyone? How about mandatory minimum health care for everyone? Talk in some terms of some basic housing for everybody, job training for people. If we invest the money in programs that give them hope for the future, can you imagine how many fewer drug users you'd have out there?
Oh, we're on the same page there. I mean, it's been proven, as we talked about earlier, as per capita use in Switzerland, Portugal, and the Netherlands, and it would replicate itself here without question. So I want to give you the last word here, Jack. Tell us what's coming up, what's on Leap's horizon, and how our listeners can help you with your goal.
Well, what's on Leap's horizon is we want to get 1 million private citizens who agree with us, who sign up to be Leap members. We don't ask for any money. There's no dues or fees. For reformers, we don't take you away from your own very important incremental work that you're doing. We don't fill your inbox up with a lot of unwanted emails, but we do this. We do guarantee that if we get what we want, it's going to solve almost all the problems for all the reformers out there working on these very important incremental ideas, because they will all be taken care of once we legalize drugs. So come to copstatelegalizeddrugs.com or leap.cc, join us. We got things you can sign up there for, petitions, and we got all sorts of things that people can do to help us accomplish these goals.
Well, that's well put, Jack. And again, I want to thank you for taking the time to come inside the Opium Den tonight and talk with me. I'm sure our listeners will find this very informative. And like I said, I never thought the people that would be of my persuasion and sitting on my side of the table would be policemen. So if that can happen, I'm pretty optimistic that we're going to be able to nail this thing.
You know how that happened with me?
Well, no, how?
3 years undercover, it occurred to me that I liked a lot of the people I was working on better than some of the people I was working for.
Well, that's a very candid comment, Jack, and we're going to let it sit right there. I appreciate it quite a bit, and good luck to everything that's going on. You're a fine man, and I'm proud to call you my friend, and let's hope that we can work together with everybody that wants to do something positive and get this thing done, okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Daniel.
Okay, thank you, Jack. Bye now. Okay, that was Jack Cole, the executive director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I hope you enjoy listening to what Jack has to say. And we thank you for coming in. So until next time, thanks for coming inside the Opium Den. I'm Daniel Williams.